Hey there, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. With me today is my good friend, Dr. Michael Murray, who is one of the legends in the field of natural health. He's written a huge number of books. He's been around for decades. He still looks amazing, by the way, well into his second half of life, and which speaks volumes about how useful his ideas are and how well they work, by the way. I think that's a good mark that you should look for. And as a recognized leader in his field, he's dedicated his life to educating physicians, patients, and the public on the healing power of nature. He's authored over 40 books, including the Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine and his latest book, The Longevity Matrix. With no further ado, enjoy this wonderful conversation with Dr. Michael Murray on optimizing mitochondrial health using nutrition and other lifestyle practices. So welcome, Dr. Murray. Such a pleasure to connect with you as always.
My pleasure. I always enjoy speaking with you. And I know that your audience is a bit different. They're highly motivated and highly educated. So I'm ready to go.
Awesome. We're going to assume some level of familiarity, basic knowledge around mitochondria. We're going to assume that listeners have already heard from a number of other speakers and experts on this topic of mitochondria. Now, with that said, one of the things that I've noticed is that many experts, including myself as someone who focuses on mitochondria, have different ways of speaking about mitochondria, are focused on different aspects of it. And I think, you know, more broadly, from the time that you were going through your university and graduate school education, and even during the time I was doing that, the mitochondria were kind of just, hey, these are one of many organelles of the cell, and this is the powerhouse of the cell, and their job is to take in carbs and fats and pump out ATP. But really in the last decade especially, there's been all this science that's emerged around really positioning mitochondria as having this central role in so many things about how our physiology works. Of course, energy generation, but also having a role in immune function and cellular defense, and having a role in many different aspects of physiology, and having a role in mitochondrial dysfunction being linked to so many different diseases and to the rate of aging itself and to physiological resilience. And, you know, mitochondria are just way more important than we realized. And I think in the last 10 years, especially, we've had this large body of evidence that continues to show just how important they are. But I'm curious sort of what your overall big picture take is on mitochondria and sort of their importance in human health.
Well, we wouldn't be alive if it was not for mitochondria, and the whole world would look a lot different without these important cellular powerhouses. And in naturopathic medicine, we've always placed a strong importance on energy and true energy. And true energy is really determined by how well your mitochondria are functioning. And what I've tried to get across for decades now is that our energy levels are a little bit like a dimmer switch. And sometimes the light bulb has a lot of dust on it and we have to clean off the light bulb. But most often it's because our dimmer switch is not turned fully bright. It's a little bit dim. And this really shows up not only in our energy levels, but also how well our brain is thinking. And one of the things that I've noticed as I've gotten older is that I'm much brighter in the morning. And as the day goes on, especially if I don't take some time to meditate or take a nap, I'm not as bright as I was in the morning. And I think that's a good indication of the importance of making sure we get enough rest and recovery to allow our mitochondria to rebound. They get a little tired if they're pumping all the time, 24/7. They need that break to cleanse and to kind of reboot and recharge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so what do you see as some of the big factors that are
dimming that dimmer switch, or dimming the light bulb, dimming the energy output? What are some of the big drivers of why there is a fatigue epidemic and an epidemic of poor mitochondrial function?
Well, yeah, it's a number of different factors, and it's kind of like the blind men and the elephant. You know, it depends on what expert you're talking to as to what they think is the most important. I try to step back and look at the whole picture and recognize that it's really an interplay of a number of different factors that determine our mitochondrial function. Particularly important are essential nutrients. If we're deficient in any nutrient, it's going to lead to impaired mitochondrial function. And when you look at nutrient deficiency, even in developed countries, you think, oh, you know, there couldn't be people walking around with nutrient deficiencies. We were overfed, but we're undernourished. And if we look at something as simple as iron deficiency, which is the most common deficiency in the world, it's rampant in certain groups in the United States. For example, in studies looking at endurance athletes, female endurance athletes or swimmers, over 80% are deficient in iron. We have a population that's becoming more plant-based in their nutritional choices. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of people becoming vegans and vegetarians, and the rate of iron deficiency in those groups is really, really high. We have children with iron deficiency. As we get older, we don't absorb iron as efficiently. And so just something as simple as an iron deficiency could be a big factor in why many people aren't having high energy levels and are experiencing low mitochondrial function. And one of my important discoveries when looking at energy levels was a study that came out in the 50s looking at how long a woman could stay on a treadmill walking at 3 miles per hour. And what they found was that it was directly related to their iron stores. If their iron stores were low, their time on that treadmill was low. But the better their iron stores, the longer they could stay on that treadmill. And I think every menstruating woman should have at least a yearly serum ferritin test that tells us the level of iron stores in the body. And if it's below 50, they need to eat more iron-rich foods. And there's two types of iron. We have heme iron, which is found in animal products, and we have non-heme iron, which is found in plant foods. And the reality is that heme iron is much better absorbed. So, for women that have really low iron levels, maybe eating some liver, a calf's liver or even fish liver, once or twice a week is a great way to boost iron levels. And of course, there are supplements and most of those supplements are the non-heme. We just have to use a sufficient level, usually 60 to 120 milligrams per day for a period of time until that level gets up. But, you know, that little recommendation, Ari, if you're a woman menstruating and you're suffering from low energy, particularly if you're a runner or a swimmer engaged in intense physical activity or exercise, get your serum ferritin level checked and make sure that you have enough iron to make energy.
Are there any other notable nutrient deficiencies that stick out to you as being common in people with chronic fatigue?
Any of the B vitamins. Our B vitamins are really important in mitochondrial function. And the mitochondria are kind of like miniature nuclear power plants. So there's a lot of chemical reactions going on there. And if we don't have a diet that's rich in protective factors like flavonoids, plant pigments, or carotenoids, or other plant-based antioxidants, then those mitochondria can become damaged, and that results in low energy levels as well. So, eating a lot of green leafy vegetables, a lot of colorful fruits and vegetables, those are really important dietary goals for enhancing mitochondrial function. And then lastly, something that I look at is, what is a person's exposure to damaging factors to the mitochondria? And my gosh, Ari, if we look at one of the worst mitochondrial damagers is Tylenol, acetaminophen. And we have 50 million Americans that regularly use acetaminophen or Tylenol on a weekly basis. And every time you take a Tylenol, it dramatically reduces your glutathione stores. And as a result, it makes your mitochondria more susceptible to damage, and that leads to decreased function. So that's an example of a really serious damaging factor to mitochondria. Cigarette smoke, vaping is absolutely deadly to mitochondrial function. Environmental toxins like pesticides, herbicides, heavy metals like lead, mercury, cadmium, a lot of different prescription and illegal drugs are all serious damagers to mitochondria. So we have to provide all essential nutrients. We have to make sure that we have a good array of antioxidants from our diet. We have to reduce exposure to damaging factors. And as I discussed at the beginning, we have to take time for rest and recovery so that our mitochondria have a chance to take a little break and cleanse, recover, and then start putting out more ATP.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, here's a little trivia. This is something that patients are always amazed of. Ari, do you know how much ATP your body makes in a day?
I want to say it's been a few years since I saw this, but I don't want to be a spoiler to the number.
No,
but
no,
I think it's like 180 kilograms of ATP per day, or 90 kilograms a day, something along those lines.
It's about your body weight. So right. If someone weighs 100 pounds, their body every single day is making about 100 pounds of ATP. If they weigh 200 pounds, they're making 200 pounds of energy every day. I think that just really puts it into perspective. Your mitochondria are producing the amount of ATP that equals your body weight every day.
And just explain to people, because maybe it's not obvious, how this could be possible and for there to be no weight gain or weight loss while this is happening.
Okay. ATP is the chemical currency for energy in our body. And it's the mitochondria's job to produce ATP. And so ATP is produced and then energy is burned in the process. And so this is just how that exchange works. The mitochondria produces that ATP. The ATP is then, it's kind of like the fire that burns the wood. That energy that is created is used for biochemical processes, and that's where we burn calories.
Mm-hmm. Got it. You mentioned phytochemicals, flavonoids and polyphenols and things of that nature. What do you see as the role of them in terms of physiology, in terms of biochemistry, and specifically as it pertains to mitochondria? And I'm curious if you're familiar with the field of research called xenohormesis.
Yes. Flavonoids are a big part of my love affair with nature. I really fell in love with flavonoids when I was at Bastyr studying naturopathic medicine. Had a great professor, Ed Madison, and just looking at the wondrous ways in which these chemicals work in our body, there are over 8,000 flavonoids that have been identified chemically. And these plant pigments are responsible for many of the medicinal effects of medicinal plants, from ginkgo, St. John's wort, bilberry, blueberry, pomegranate, berries in general. And what we know about these compounds is they are nature's biological response modifiers. What that means is they modify our response to the environment, and they are extremely pharmacologically active. But nature has a way of making sure that they're under control. It's really kind of a miracle when you look at it. So let's say that this is a flavonoid. When we ingest a flavonoid,
also just describe it for people listening who may not be watching the video.
Okay. Oh, okay. So a flavonoid, I'm just holding up a little clicker, a little remote. And when we ingest a flavonoid, it is quickly bound to another molecule. I'm going to grab a paper clip. So the paper clip gets bound to the remote, or the flavonoid gets bound by sulfur or glucuronic acid, and then it circulates in our body in a bound form that's inactive. So for years they thought, well, flavonoids aren't that important to human nutrition, because when you ingest them, they get bound and they become inactive. Well, naturopaths have always believed that nature has a way of providing the benefits of these flavonoids. And so it was discovered that in areas of inflammation or damage or low mitochondrial function, cells start secreting a compound called glucuronidase. And what that enzyme does is it breaks that bond, and it frees up that flavonoid that then gets transferred into the cell. And they did a really interesting study in Spain a few years ago that proved this concept. And what they did was they took cells and they damaged their mitochondria. And they showed that when they damage that mitochondria, it causes the cell to release that glucuronic acid that broke the bond between the flavonoid and the glucuronic acid, and that allowed the flavonoid to get into the cell and not only get transferred to the cell's nucleus, but also to the mitochondria. In both the nucleus and the mitochondria, the flavonoid exerted an effect on the cellular genetics or the mitochondrial genetics to reduce inflammation and to promote repair. So they showed that that flavonoids, in this particular case, they looked at quercetin, was able to repair that mitochondria, which that was not thought possible prior to that. So flavonoids are really important, and they've been a mainstay of my diet for over 43 years when I first started hearing about them. Which is a long time ago, but I've been at this a while. I turned 65 in a month, and wow. I
want to be like you when I'm 65.
Well, I'm sure you'll be even better. We're learning so much more than we knew before. I feel really blessed that some people would think obsessive, but I don't think so. I've made a goal. I've had a target of flavonoid intake every day for the last 45 years, practically. And I think I have this on my website, drmurray.com. You just go to search and type flavonoids. I have an article in there, and I talk about them being superfoods and how to calculate your dietary intake. And I give you an idea of what my targets are through diet and supplementation. But You know, when we talk about superfoods, we're really talking about foods that are really rich in flavonoids. Why is cacao or dark chocolate so important? Well, it's the flavonoids. What about berries? You know, what about pomegranate? What about green tea? What about St. John's wort, ginkgo, grapeseed extract? It goes on and on and on. It's these flavonoids, and there are different types of flavonoids, but they all share some common features. And one of the most important features that they share is an ability to improve mitochondrial function.
Okay, I wanna go one or maybe two or maybe three layers deeper into this, into territory that is almost never discussed. And I think given your very long expertise in natural health and nutrition, being the legend of natural health that you are, and your unique interest in flavonoids, and my unique interest in flavonoids, there's some stories here that I think might be worth delving into that I'm pretty sure won't be touched on by any other expert. So there's a story around antioxidants and oxidants that is a very distorted and oversimplified story that has been widely circulating for many, many decades. And the story is very simply oxidants and oxidative stress equals bad. Antioxidants are good. And the more antioxidants we have, the better. And there are a variety of lines of evidence that have made it clear that this story is overly simplistic and that there are many layers that are incorrect. For example, there are many studies published online debunking the whole free radical theory of aging, Harman's free radical theory of aging that's been around for many decades. And there's many, many studies, as you probably know, Dr. Murray, where they have tested various kinds of antioxidants and found them to not be particularly effective, and in some cases to actually be counterproductive as far as disease prevention or extending lifespan, both in animal models and in humans. Conversely, we also have the examples of things like exercise and hormetic stressors, which increase free radicals or reactive oxygen species, and yet paradoxically have a lifespan enhancing and disease prevention effect. So this basic, again, just to recap, this basic model of oxidants are bad, antioxidants are good, and the more that we have antioxidants quenching the oxidants, and the more we do things to avoid big spikes of oxidants, the longer we live, the slower the aging process is, the more we prevent disease. And again, we have these lines of evidence showing that many antioxidants don't actually work to prevent disease or extend lifespan, and many things that spike, that create large amounts of oxidants, paradoxically extend lifespan and prevent disease. I'm curious to what extent you've spent time like looking at this whole story and how you reconcile all of those things.
Okay, so a lot of times when we're looking at an antioxidant or an oxidant, we're looking at a chemical reaction or in an in vitro or test tube study that has really no bearing, you know. So for example, if we look at Flavonoids are generally referred to as antioxidants. In a chemical reaction or in a test tube study, they show antioxidant activity. The problem is that you cannot achieve the level of concentration to produce that antioxidant effect in the body. Does that mean that they don't have antioxidant effects? No, they have indirect antioxidant effects. And the things that you were talking about stressors to our antioxidant system, they have the same effect as the beneficial compounds that exert systemic antioxidant effects like antioxidants. We have genetic controllers, and we have very unique set of feedback stimuli kind of like thermostats in the form of receptors on our cells that will activate signals to our nucleus to activate certain genes. And, I don't know if your audience or this audience is familiar with NRF2, but NRF2 is kind of the body's antioxidant response. And that's really what we want to be looking at. And again, if you look at what stimulates NRF2 activation, it's both stressors to the antioxidant system and natural compounds that support the antioxidant system. So you eliminate that. That's what seems to be an enigma, but it's really not, because you just look at what happens on a cellular level. And exercise is a great example.
So you're spot on. Everything you're saying is the way to reconcile it. But just for listeners, explain NRF2 in a little bit more depth, and explain the concept of, you know, like, let me put it this way. Let's say that you had just a simple machine, like a hunk of metal, like a car or something like that. The more stress you apply to it, the more that you take it over bumpy dirt roads, and, you know, subject it to different forces acting on it and getting dirty and getting wet and taking big, you know, taking it off jumps, the more it's going to break down. But the difference between that and the human body is we are a living, intelligent, adaptive machine that is designed to respond to the stressors that we're subjected to. And make adaptations to it. And we have a system in our body built into our biology that is designed to respond to stressors by becoming stronger and more robust. And as you alluded to, one of the primary pathways that happens through is the NRF2 pathway and the endogenous antioxidant system. So just assume people have no knowledge that there is an internal antioxidant system, and explain how all of that works.
Yeah, that was very well done. That was beautiful. That's a great analogy, and I'm going to steal it. That's so good. We are designed to have stress in our lives to create life. If you take a single cell organism like an amoeba and you put it in what we think is a perfect environment, it would die, because it needs that stress in order to grow and to thrive. And we're the same way. We need stress in every aspect of our life in order to grow and thrive and evolve, both individually and as a race. So our bodies and our cells have mechanisms to take stressful situations and help us adapt to that stress. And as you said, exercise is such a great analogy, because the more load you put on a body, the stronger it's going to become. Of course, it has to be reasonable. It can't be overwhelming stress, but continued stress leads to an adaptation of improving our ability to have endurance, stamina, and strength. And the same thing happens on a cellular level. And when we look at what are those cellular mechanisms that are responsible for helping a cell adapt to stress, it's really interesting. And this NRF2 system is kind of a stimulus to our antioxidant system. And we have compounds in our body that exert antioxidant activity. We also have enzymes that exert enzymatic antioxidant activity. So there's a lot of vehicles that our body produces that nullify oxidative stress. And like anything in nature, it's always a double-edged sword. Our body can also produce oxidants, because that's what we use to kill infecting organisms and things that might do us harm. And there are situations when our body is desiring to produce inflammatory processes, because they're important in promoting a healing reaction. So we don't want to shut any of that down.
And I want to emphasize what you said there, just to point it out to listeners, as because it's a big key of why this story of oxidants are bad, antioxidants are good is so misguided. Because those oxidants are, again, as you said, serving a purpose. The body is designed to produce them. It's not a mistake. They're not just bad guys. The body's not producing them by accident as some horrible thing that's gone wrong in the design of human beings. It's intelligent. They're there for a purpose. They serve many vital signaling roles. They serve in immune defenses, and they serve as part of the adaptation system in response to exercise and other hormetic stressors, where the presence of those reactive oxygen species is used as a signal for mitochondria to grow bigger and stronger and for mitochondrial biogenesis. So when you quench too much of those free radicals, for example, when they did studies many years ago where they supplemented antioxidants to people doing exercise, what they found is that it actually canceled out or mostly negated many of the metabolic benefits of doing exercise. So, you know, again, those reactive oxygen species, these oxidants are not just bad guys, they're there serving a purpose. We don't want to just be constantly trying to pound as much glutathione and antioxidants, exogenous antioxidants, as we possibly can to suppress those reactive oxygen species, because that is actually based on a mistaken and naive, ignorant view of human physiology that's incomplete. And that's, I think, part of the magic of these flavonoid molecules too, is they're not just indiscriminate direct antioxidants, they're working with our endogenous right. antioxidant system.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of different areas of focus in research in nutrition and in medicine in general, and it's been really interesting to view it. One of the latest is looking at everything, something is anti-inflammatory, it's going to promote life extension, because inflammation plays such a big role in so many detrimental aspects of human health. But they did a study. This is paradigm shifting. They looked at there was an editorial that basically, I'm paraphrasing the article, but everything that we thought that we knew about pain relief was wrong, because what they found was that the treatment of acute pain led to an increase in chronic pain. And it's the chronic pain that's created this opioid problem. And what they found was that if you're using nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, after surgery or whatever, maybe a trauma, an injury of some sort, that it reduces the acute inflammatory process. And in the process of suppressing that inflammation, it also suppresses the formation of compounds in our body called resolvins. And these are compounds that resolve inflammation. And I think they're going to be treating pain a lot differently in the future than they are what we're doing now. We have a tendency to think that pharmacology, drug therapy, is at the pinnacle, but we're in the dark ages still. I think it's foolish to think that we're not, because if you look at any class of drug, and you look at the mechanism of action and the long term effects, whether you're talking about sleeping pills, whether you're talking about anti inflammatories, you're talking about antidepressants. You're looking at, they just discovered that all these cognitive enhancing drugs, they actually increase the loss of cognition. And we see that with blood pressure medications. We see that with with just about every class of medication, they end up creating the problem that they were originally designed to address. And when we're looking at mitochondrial function and longevity, I think finding alternatives to conventional medicines is the way to go. That's one of the basic foundations of my latest book, the Longevity Matrix. And yeah, we want to support our body with all these wonderful longevity aids. But from what I look at, whether you're talking about proton pump inhibitors for treating esophageal reflux, or sleeping pills, or Tylenol, or whatever, you look at those sorts of drugs, and you look at their impact on life extension and their mortality risk. These are putting people into the grave sooner, and just helping people get off of these drugs is a great way to extend their life. And that's one of my big missions in life, to help people live a long and healthy life. And it's hard to do that if you're on a medication, a drug.
I think that this really gets into a difference in paradigms, like the foundational paradigms through which you are seeking to improve human health, or within conventional medicine, generally, it's not about improving health. It's about trying to fix disease, reverse pathology, or stop pathology. And the general paradigm is always based on a model of, let's do this sort of biochemical analysis of what's going on, what are the pathways and the specific molecules that are out of whack that are driving this disease process, and then let's create a drug to interfere or to interrupt with that cascade of chemical reactions. And that paradigm is distinct from one of looking at the body as an intelligent system and saying, why is the body doing this? Why is the body making this shift in this direction? And how can we, what can we do? How can we understand the root causes of that, of why this intelligent system is feeling like it needs to respond in this way, such that we can coax it back into its healthy regulation, rather than interrupting the dumb system that's randomly sort of gone astray and is making these accidents by having high cholesterol or upregulating hormones that act on the kidneys such that now you have high blood pressure, or changing neurotransmitters in the brain, levels of the brain, such that now you have depression or anxiety. And therefore we need a drug to fix this mistake that the body's making. It's a paradigm of saying, well, why is the body regulating neurotransmitters in this way, or regulating blood pressure in this way? And why are these cholesterol and triglycerides being regulated by this intelligent system in this way? And how can we work with this intelligent system to bring it back into balance? And the treatments that one arrives at are wildly different depending on which one of those paradigms you operate in. And it's very unfortunate, in my mind, that the dominant conventional medical paradigm which most people associate with quote unquote the science, as the more scientifically advanced one, is one that sees the body as a dumb machine that makes all these mistakes, that requires drugs to interrupt all of these pathological processes, disease processes. So anyway, I just thought I'd add that to echo your sentiments there.
Yeah, it's going to be, I want to stick around as long as possible, because it's exciting the route that science is taking. If you really have your pulse on the research, it's clear that a new paradigm is emerging. And I really like this focus on not only our physiology, but also the microbiome. And I think we're going to be looking at ways to influence the microbiome in a much more sophisticated and meaningful way than what we're doing now. And I'm excited to see what that might lead to, because there's such a symbiotic relationship between our health and the health of our microbiome. And it's not, you know, probiotics are, they're really not all that important. And we focus on them way too much. It's almost like a reverse germ theory. It's the microbiome is like a most often it's like a very rich environment, kind of like an Amazonian forest, and you're trying to change the Amazonian forest by throwing some grass seeds out there. There's no room for it. Mm-hmm. So there has to be ways of altering it, and there are, and we're learning more and more what's important in terms of our lifestyle, our diet, our thoughts, all our hormonal levels, all these things that have nothing to do with, you know, taking probiotics.
And there's a microbiome mitochondria axis as well, a gut mitochondria axis. And we know that, you know, for example, microbes interact with some of these plant phytochemicals and flavonoids in ways that ultimately affect the mitochondria. And that if you maybe don't have a healthy microbiome, those things can't function as well. For example, the conversion of fibers, plant food fibers, into short chain fatty acids and butyrate, which heavily impact on mitochondrial function, or the conversion of ellagic acid into urolithin A, which is a powerful promoter of mitophagy, right? So that just to amplify what you're saying about this connection between the microbiome and everything else, including mitochondria.
Yeah, and we've been talking about flavonoids. So everyone knows that dark chocolate is good for the circulation. So researchers looked at 9 different metabolites of the flavanols in dark chocolate. And what they found was that these metabolites, in an objective measurement of the effects on blood flow, they were 16 times more powerful than what they thought was the active compound in dark chocolate. Mm-hmm. So, so the type of gut bacteria that we have, if we have the right type of gut bacteria, it seems to lead to even more beneficial effects from various food components that we know are healthful. So, it's an emerging science, and it's going to be fun to see how it all works out. And I'm really thrilled for myself as I head up to my 65th birthday, because I had a lot of these epiphanies, just as you've had, and that has allowed us to create our own individual philosophy of diet, lifestyle, attitudes, spirituality, and it pays off. I know it's paid off for me, and I've been hanging out with some high school buddies that chose a different path with their lifestyle and diet, and they're not as vibrant, energetic, and they don't have the quality of life that I have. So
Dr. Murray, I'm 39. I graduated high school about 20 years ago, and a lot of the guys that I went to high school with looked like, you know, like middle-aged men. You know, I still feel like a young guy. You know, I'm very fit. I have tons of energy. I'm lean. I'm in great shape. And I look at some of the people I went to high school with and I'm like, oh my God, you know, living a healthy lifestyle and eating a great diet really makes a massive difference. There's no question about it. You maybe can't see it when you're 20, but you can definitely see it when you're 40 and beyond.
Yeah, and if you're older, it's never too late to get on the path. It's never too late. You know, it's not about living longer. It's about living better now. If you take care of living better now, the longer part is just gonna fall into place. I didn't, you know, when I was you know, in my 20s, I didn't think about, hey, I'm gonna do this because I want to live longer. I did it because I want to feel better now. I want to be, I want my body to be functioning as best as it can now. Mm-hmm. And if you always take that approach, the longevity part should just fall into place.
Yeah. So I want to wrap up with your thoughts on maybe some of your top superfoods, your top flavonoids, and your top supplements that you would advise people to consume or to perhaps experiment with if they're dealing with fatigue issues or poor mitochondrial function.
Yeah, I think it's really important. A lot of times people look for that magic bullet, and it's like, and sometimes a magic bullet's like a beautiful piece of art. But you have to have the framework of the house, and you have to have the drywall, and you have to have that foundation. When I was in practice, I would ask patients to bring in all of their supplements, and sometimes they would come in with two big shopping bags full of all the supplements they're taking. And by the way, we had a name for these people in the health food industry. We called them good customers. But I found a lot of times they were taking a lot of accessory items and not really having a strong foundation. And we can build upon a foundation, but at the very least, everybody should be taking a high quality multiple vitamin and mineral formula. If a woman is menstruating, I would recommend getting a yearly serum ferritin test because of the importance of iron, and sometimes just the amount of iron that's in a multiple vitamin and mineral formula is enough to keep those ferritin levels up. We've learned a lot about vitamin D3 lately. I think it's really important. So get your vitamin D3 levels checked, and you know, just do it a couple of times, and you know if you're in the range or not. And most people need about 2,000 to 5,000 IUs daily of D3. Then I'm a big fan of fish oil, taking 1,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA daily. And then take some sort of a flavonoid-rich extract, a grapeseed extract or pine bark or resveratrol product. They have a lot of overlap, these sorts of products. It could be a curcumin product, but some sort of broad spectrum plant-based antioxidant. It could be a super greens. And then it's just a matter of flooding your body with all sorts of wondrous plant compounds by eating lots of green leafy vegetables, mixing it up with your berries. I'm a big fan of nuts and seeds. As long as you have no allergies, they're great foods, and they're really nutrient dense. For people that need more support for mitochondrial function, just the basics, I think, are N-acetylcysteine. I like CoQ10 and PQQ. They're kind of like the spark plugs of mitochondria, and they have been shown to increase energy levels. They work very, very well together, usually 200 milligrams of CoQ10 with 20 milligrams of PQQ. And I don't know if people have talked about PQQ. People are probably familiar with CoQ10, but PQQ stands for pyroloquinoline quinone. That's why we call it PQQ. And it's literally been found on intergalactic dust. So it's from stardust, and it's something that we can't manufacture in our body. So it will be designated an essential nutrient at some point. It's a very powerful mitochondrial enhancer. We don't need a lot of it. 10 to 20 milligrams is a day is more than enough, and it's been shown to improve cellular energy levels. It activates an enzyme called AMPK. We were supposed to talk a little bit about that, Ari. I got off on other subjects, but hopefully someone else talks about the importance of AMPK for mitochondrial function. But I really like PQQ, carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid. These are all really, really important ones. I'm not a big fan of NMN or NR, these nicotinamide products. I look at it, I have a different view on that. Again, it's listening to the wisdom of the body. You know, this is something that it's such a critical component to mitochondrial function. Why is it dropping as people age? It's not dropping because it's a lack of dietary intake. It's dropping because there's an enzymatic imbalance that's associated with aging, and flavonoids like quercetin have been shown to activate this longevity gene that naturally boosts NAD plus levels. So I just think it's a more elegant and rational way. It's kind of like you have a boat and it has a bunch of holes in it, and those holes represent ways we lose NMN, and you're throwing more NMN in the boat, but it's leaking out. Why not patch up those holes? And the way that we patch up those holes is to have a flavonoid rich diet. And you know, I know people are going in for IVs for NAD and glutathione, and I've never done any of those IVs. I think you're filling up a lifeboat that is leaking, and it may be important in certain situations where it's critical to get those nutrients. But you know, let's fix all those holes in the boat, and then they don't have to be getting those IVs. That's my thought on it. And
I agree with you completely. Dr. Murray, are there any final words that you want to leave people with and tell people where they can find you and follow your work?
Okay. They can follow me at drmurray.com, and they can find all my work there. My final words are this. In working with people and trying to help them improve their health or to live longer, I came to the realization that the most important thing is to have a reason to live longer. So find your reason why. Find your purpose. Create a vehicle in your life that makes a difference in the lives of others. Practice gratitude. Express appreciation. Share of yourself. Give of yourself. These things are self-nurturing, and they promote health. I think they also promote longevity and a reason to be here as well. So all these are covered in my book, The Longevity Matrix. I start off with some exercises that help people identify why they want to be here. And I go through my 10 biggest reasons to live on a regular basis. They just keep me fired up, and that creates energy. We can create energy. We've all had that experience where we've been dead tired, but then something excites us, and wow, we're just flooded with all this energy. That wakes up our mitochondria. Everything is connected, our mind, our heart, and our body. They're all connected, and when we are flush with passion, flush with energy, everything works better.
There's a field of research. I don't know if you've seen any of the studies from this area. It's called mitochondrial psychobiology.
Oh, I love it.
And it is on the mind mitochondria connection.
I'm gonna Google that when we're done.
There's a great researcher who I've interviewed named Martin Picard. He's one of the primary researchers in that field. Great guy, brilliant, and has done some really amazing research. And I believe that there is a ton to what you're saying about the sort of the ikigai, the reason for being. What is your purpose? What is your passion? What gets you up out of bed and makes you want to get up and live? And I think not only is that important in some sort of mystical or purely psychological way, I think it ties directly in to our mitochondria and our cellular energy production in pretty much exactly the same, the way that you just described there.
100%. 100%.
Dr. Murray, thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure to connect with you, as it always is. And I look forward to our next conversation.
I do too as well.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family. Help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.